fish heads, roly poly fish heads, fish heads, fish heads, eat them up, yum. Fish heads, fish heads, roly poly fish heads.
Laughing happy fish heads in the evening, floating in the soup.
Fish heads, fish.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Catch It, Cook It, and Eat It. I'm your host, Ben Sargent, and we're talking today about the food of the Roman orgy. I am super excited today to have with me Mike Ozinski, a guy who can be called a major player in the fall of Wall Street, the financial crisis we are in the midst of, but someone who is also picking up the pieces in a number of ways. And one of those is with the, maybe we should call it the largest New York environmental catastrophe to date. Mike is an oyster farmer, but you didn't start as one. Where'd you start?
Well, I came to New York in 1985 working as a software programmer on Wall Street, and I eventually carved a little niche into the securitization of mortgages, that is, turning pools of mortgages into bonds. I wrote the industry standards piece of software to perform that task, and of course, we all know that now that the securitization of subprime mortgages has caused a huge worldwide financial crisis.
So I went out harvesting oysters the other day with you, and I have to say that you have a pretty idyllic life there, and in the sense that you get up early in the morning and you go out and you harvest your oysters, and it's hard work. But when we look back, you have like this beautiful house, and it's a really great piece of real estate, and all that didn't happen just through being this tough oyster farmer. Is that right?
No, that's correct.
So give me a little background, I guess, on just because I don't have a clue about really what, you know, how this all went down, but what happened to cause this financial crisis?
Well, several, in my opinion, right, I was in the software business or in the securitization business from 1985 to 2000. At that point, I retired from software business and Wall Street and began an oyster farmer. But, you know, obviously everybody pays attention to what's going on. And you can see this crisis had its roots in several sort of misconceptions. Mm-hmm. And of course, some fraudulent activity on the part of Wall Street banks and some, you know, just naivete.
And your job basically was, you were especially good at writing the code, writing the programs that turned, is it mortgages into bonds?
That's correct.
Okay. So I guess one could say that you really didn't know so much that what you were doing was going to end up being now what is a problem.
I never did. I thought I was quite proud of the work I'd done.
Right.
The piece of software, it was a million lines of code. You can imagine how many years that takes to write. And I was even more proud that when we sold it to almost every large investment bank in the world, I was quite proud of that.
And you started out a shrimp fisherman, is that right?
Well, my first job out of college was, I couldn't get a job, so I worked on shrimp boats out off of Port Canaveral.
And then the next thing you know, you're on Wall Street. Your wife was sick at the time, and you decided you needed a real job. Is that
right? Right. My wife became critically ill, mm-hmm. had a kidney disease, and mm-hmm. Fortunately she recovered after 5 years. But we needed insurance.
Okay.
So I got a job at a medical university in Atlanta, entering data, which is sort of the bottom of the food chain in the world of software, or not even software, in the world of computers. Entering data is the most repetitive, boring job in the world.
Right.
But that allowed me to take one course in computers. I took one computer course. I learned a program, and I wrote a program that sort of did my job, and they fired me. But I got another job and another job, and eventually, you know, I wanted to see the big city, so I came up to New York and got a job at First Solomon Brothers and Lehman Brothers and Kidder Peabody. And then I was fortunate that I was able to acquire the rights to my own software and sell it to many firms.
So that was sort of before the financial crash.
That's correct.
So you got out at a time when am I right in saying that you were almost forced out by selling your
My so-called partners decided that they wanted the whole business, not half the business, and they exercised an option in my contract and paid me out and bought me out. And you know, at that time I was ready to go. I was a little, you know, Wall Street, staring at computers can be, you know, you only have one life to lead. Is that what you want to do with your life? Just right. Stare at numbers, count other people's money.
Right.
And so I left Wall Street.
I remember you telling me the first day you harvested oysters, you looked at yourself in the mirror and you said, damn, I look a lot better than I did working on Wall Street.
Yes,
one day out on the water.
Yeah, you know, because you're out, it's hard labor. It's you know, it's almost serfdom, to be honest with you. But you're on the water, something semi mystical about working atop the water. There's something about it. I don't know whether you're attuned to the cosmos. The tides are more important to you. The tides, the winds, all the currents, those are the things that you really care about. And of course, those are all driven by cosmic events like the moon and the sunspots or whatever. Right. So you are, you know, definitely controlled by nature. Your life is consumed by nature. And growing any animal, harvesting any crop, and here is an animal that's totally, its whole life is controlled by water temperature, the movement of tides. So these are the things that are now important to you, not the day of the week and what the interest rates are and those kinds of things.
And I was pretty sure that your wife was probably shocked when you said, honey, I'm going to take up oyster farming. But in fact, it was the opposite. Is that right?
Right. It was her idea. We you know, sold the business. We were nothing to do. Retired. I was 44 or something like that. And she said, you know, Cornell Maritime Extension is having a course on growing oysters. And we both took the course and we grew 2,000 oysters. And I said, well, I have nothing to do. In Greenport, the village I live in, at the end of the North Fork of Long Island, was the oyster capital of New York. I said, why don't we grow them commercially? What's it cost? $100 for the permits. And now I'm enslaved by that $100 has totally bought my life. I can't leave. I have to grow them all the year. I have to tend them constantly.
I think it's awesome. I mean, I'm jealous. I think, you know, having something that sort of determines your life like that, when you get up in the morning and, you know, and like you said, you're totally attuned to the weather and the currents and the tide and all that. Tell me a little bit about the history, I guess, of the oyster in New York, the Hudson and the East River. Why, the reason I'm drawing this parallel, this connection, is because I think it's interesting that there was a catastrophe in the sense that we lost our oyster. And why is that?
Well, as you said, the oyster was the staple of the New York diet for hundreds of years. It was the staple of the American Indians that lived here when the Dutch first settled here and the English. All the way through, I think, about to 1920, the vast hordes of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, a German wave of immigration, all ate oysters. There were oyster shops all over New York. That area south of 14th Street along the Hudson River, Little West 12th, all that area was nothing but oyster scows. That is, these scows were docked there permanently. Oysters would be barged in and processed, either, you know, sold raw into Manhattan, or they would be canned on the spot and shucked and sent shucked all around the city. But it was the staple of the Manhattan diet.
It's awesome. Somebody said to me that it was socioeconomic sort of leveler in that everybody liked oysters. It didn't matter where you came from, how much money you had, that no matter how many oysters there were, even if the price was unbelievably low, people still loved it and did with it the same sorts of things. It wasn't like a high class way of, you know, cooking an oyster or a low class way.
All economic strata would consume oysters, you know, oysters and champagne. You know, or just a oyster, you know, the common people. If you were to buy a cookbook from 100 years ago and look up oysters, you would see 7 or 8 pages of oyster recipes. They were commonly consumed in the home. People on the East Coast of the United States ate more oyster meat than beef 100 years ago.
Right. And what I guess, what makes oyster farming a healthier for the environment form of aquaculture?
Well, oysters are extremely good for the culture. Not only are they extremely healthy for an individual to consume, but oysters themselves consume algae in the water. Each oyster will purify about 50 gallons of water per day. One of the major forms of pollution is overblooms of algae. So the more oysters you have in the water, the less likely you're going to have an overbloom of algae. Number two, oysters, those oysters that you put out there create a reef that all the small fry in the bay will then seek shelter from the larger fish, and there's a you've now created a community for thousands. You were there yesterday. You saw all, you couldn't help but notice all every time you lift up a cage, hundreds and hundreds of fish from the size of your palm to, you know, the size of you know, one of your fingernails are living in these cages, and you know, they, of course, they'll grow up, they'll mature, they'll go out into the bay and spawn.
So it creates what you're saying is a floor, an atmosphere, a reef, basically. Mm-hmm. It's where other species can survive.
And that's correct.
Thrive. Huh. And right now, who are you? So you've got, I mean, I went out there. It is tough work. It's you don't use a pneumatic lift or dredge or anything. You're up there cranking, or in yesterday's case, I'm cranking.
Right.
and you're connecting the cages, and then up they come, and it's really, really hands-on. I mean, is there is that something you choose? Is there romance in that, or is that just the way it's done?
Well, other people may have a pneumatic lift, but you know, those cost, you know, anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000, right? I'd like to keep the capitalization low, and the more mechanical parts you have, the more things you have to repair. Here is just a simple 10-to-1 ratio on a winch, right? So. Right. All I have to do is keep lubricating that, hopefully. And even I can put that back together were it to fail. So, I mean, the simpler it is, the less maintenance it is, in my opinion.
What I think is interesting is even with oysters, you do sometimes throw numbers out there, and there's like small calculations you're doing in your head. I don't think this is like every fisherman here that we're talking to. I think you must bring some of your history to this new job of yours.
Well, you're always thinking about what's the optimal way to grow these things and how to market them, how to sell them. I mean, you're always, one of my concerns has always been, you know, it's what's been devastating the oyster growing is the fact that they're never consumed in the home anymore. And all the canneries, the East Coast used to have, you know, literally hundreds and thousands of canneries, and those have all disappeared.
Right.
I think there's only one left in New Jersey on the entire East Coast of the United States.
Right. Yeah, I was even talking to the guys in your town after we left. They were saying this whole community was built up on oyster industry.
And it was very prosperous. Yeah. Now it's sadly, you know, it's a second home kind of situation, which, you know, takes the heart and soul out of a people.
I think. But, I mean, what you're doing now, you don't have a second job. I mean, you have transformed your entire livelihood now is based on this population of oysters that you've created.
That's it. You know, fall is, of course, the time to eat oysters. Now the oysters are plump. They're getting ready to hibernate, so I am very busy. You know, I got up at 4 this morning. It's 3. I just finished. We met, you know, 45 minutes ago in Brooklyn, and I just made my last delivery of the day.
Somebody told me that an oyster spends, it's basically a large part of its life preparing for one massive ejaculation.
Well, it does spend its whole year. Yeah, it's true that, you know, water temperature is everything, and they're like right now they're putting on fat so they can hibernate, survive the hibernation.
But how is hibernating any different from what they do regularly? It's not like they're shooting around like
partying.
They don't
move, but when they're not hibernating, they put on glycogen. As soon as the water warms, they begin building up glycogen, which will then enhance their sexual organs. They will become, you know, 40% of their body weight will be their sexual organs by middle of July, in my case. As soon as the water temperature reaches 70, they will then release in a spawn all that egg and sperm, whichever they're carrying. And so their whole cycle is to make that one huge spawn and then to build up afterwards. It takes them – there's two reasons why I don't sell oysters in July and August. One is after the spawn, the meats are thin and watery. And number two, it is true that oysters that are – raised in water over 80 degrees Fahrenheit should not be consumed at all. There is a danger of a bacteria called Vibrio.
So, well, we'll get to that in one second. I'm really stuck here on the ejaculation of oysters. Sorry. But so you're saying that they don't taste as good immediately following because they're poop. They're exhausted.
They are spent. Male or female, they are spent.
Okay.
Now, it's odd that some people, the sort of month before they spawn, they have a very large gonad in them, and it's a creamier taste. Obviously, we know where that comes from. And some people prefer that taste, and other people don't like that taste. But it was true that that would be the moment when they were engorged with egg and sperm that they would be canned in the old way.
In the old way. So back
they were
in the day,
the fattest possible moment of their life.
That's what they liked most. But now tastes differ a little bit.
Back then, you know, people were eating them for protein. Right. The most, consumption of protein would be at that moment.
Somebody told me, I think it was a Canal Street plan where it was sort of like all you can eat oysters and you would pay. But, you know, if you abused the all you can eat concept, they gave you a special oyster, and that was essentially an oyster that was old. I had probably been in warmer waters and was half open, and the idea was that you would learn your lesson, you probably wouldn't eat for 3 days after that, and you would be more thoughtful of the Canal Street plan after that.
It is definitely true that you want to trust the people that are serving you raw oysters,
right? And I guess so, tell me what is the fear of what I mean, I know they're making regulations right now on warmer water oysters, or at least talking about making some regulations.
Yeah, they are threatening the Gulf.
And why is that? What can you get from eating? Are we safe with the oysters around here?
Oh, yeah. You always want to eat the northern oyster. Always sells at a huge premium to the southern oyster. And not only does it taste better, but it is much safer. And in the south, and you can eat southern oysters uncooked in the months with R, in the colder months. But in the warmer months, you do not want to eat an oyster. I mean, I grew up on the Gulf of Mexico, and I ate oysters my whole life. Now I know that, you know, they should be cooked in the summer down there. And that is what the FDA is threatening to ban all sale of Gulf Coast oysters for 8 months out of the year.
And what's the disease that you could acquire?
Vibrio. Vibrio, as in, I think the full name of that bacteria is called Vibrio cholera. And I think we all know cholera is a dangerous bacteria.
Okay, point taken. All right, and you heard it here. I am here with Mike Kaczynski, who is really the brains behind a beautiful operation in Greenport, New York. I really, really hope you all get to try his oysters. Chances are, if you ever make it to any of the sort of high-end boutique restaurants in New York City, you will have tried some of Mike's oysters. We'll be right back after the break.
The world is an oyster, locked in a shell. You like the taste of it, can't take the smell. I can't sleep to save my life. The day is done, but I don't think I got it right. I don't wanna guess right now. You're probably just what I need. I can't stand your mouth. The world is an oyster, locked in a shell.
Today's program is brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market. Check out their online specials in store at www.fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, we're back. Catch it, cook it, eat it. I'm here with Mike Kaczynski from Widow's Whole Oysters. This guy knows more about oysters than most, but not because he grew up with it from a young age, but because it sort of fell in his lap, and his whole life turned upside down at one point. And this was sort of your how would you describe what is oystering to you right now, apart from a job? Is it something more?
Well, it's all my concentration, right? Anything I do, I try to concentrate at, and I get a lot of pleasure out of it. Hard work. I get a few dollars out of it. And I also, you know, I'm surprised at the reception amongst the chefs in New York. It's a very nice feeling to be well received at some of the most famous restaurants in New York.
It's incredible. And did you take any classes in being a salesman, or do you just call up, these guys and the best restaurants in the city and say, hey, I'm new to the industry and I got some great oysters. Would you like to try
them? That's about my pitch. I have a new oyster farm. And at that time, you know, I used to, when I had a software business, I used to entertain over. I had an office at Union Square, so Union Square and Gramercy Tavern. So I called up Tom Colicchio and I said, Tom, I'm an oyster farmer. You don't know me, but I used to eat here quite a bit. Would you like to try these?
In a suit and tie back in the day.
And, you know, guys like Tom, I mean, he was very supportive. Ben Pollinger at Union Square, he's now at Oceana. Eric Repair, Dave Pasternak, all these guys. I mean, they go out of their way to support small farmers like me because it's a pain. You know, I don't deliver frequently, you know, once a week.
And you don't have a guy coming to do that job.
I do it myself. I like to do it. I love Manhattan. Right. I'm sorry. I like New York. And so it's an excuse to come in, you know, it sort of bridges the end of Long Island with, you know, my former life in the city.
Right. And does it give you a chance to talk to these guys? And I mean, are they around when you drop off your
oysters?
Yes,
usually are. I mean, lately I've been coming in early in the morning, but, you know, I always, you know, a lot of these chefs, you know, they'll turn to what's going on in the bay. What are the people catching? They want to know. I mean, that's how, you know, that's how their that's why their restaurants are so good, because they care about things like that. It's not just about, you know, pushing the most covers and stuff. They want to know what's fresh, what's happening out there.
Does someone like Dave Pasternak ever, like, you know, ask you for a specific size oyster or like a
Oh, it's very common. The French chefs, Eric Repair, got to have, you know, 3 to 3 1/4 inch. Petite, same thing at the Four Seasons.
Yeah,
I mean, like a Grand Central Oyster Bar, they're like a big oyster. You know, you get to know what everybody likes, right in the business.
Oh, that's fun. Walk us through. We have some oysters here with us, which is great. This was sort of these were the last ones here, and I think this is going to freak some people out, but it's true that when you eat an oyster, right, Mike, you are actually eating it live.
That's correct. It's the only animal you eat that's still alive when you eat it.
And if you're not eating it live, you might want to think again.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You'll know if you're not eating a live animal, let me tell you.
All right. So, and these oysters don't grow pearls, is that right?
You know, I say that, but this summer I was at an event with Eric in the Hamptons, and sure enough, opened up an oyster, gave it to a woman, and she had a little gray-green, beautiful little pearl.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, so this is incredible. So you just shucked an oyster here. We won't say to the listening audience how you shucked it, because we left our knife behind. This proves that you've become an expert, because he basically just used a paring knife for that. And I am about to, I think, experience here in Brooklyn, Bushwick. It's going to take me right to the sea, I'm imagining. Right?
It's the widow's hole oyster.
The widow's hole oyster. I'll wait till you get that one off. And these are juicy. I mean, they have a nice sort of deep, like, what do you call this? The holding...
the liqueur in it?
The liqueur. Yeah. The liqueur.
And that means how fresh the oyster is. The more liqueur in the oyster, the better. That means it was just taken out of the water. As a matter of fact, anybody who ever eats a raw oyster can demand to see the shipping tag. Okay. And the restaurant must show it to you by law. Mm-hmm. And that'll show you when it was harvested, when it was shipped.
Okay. And let's have this. 1, 2, 3.
Wow. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you, too.
Awesome. Is it a myth that that oysters make you feel sexy?
You know, I don't think it's a total myth. Old wives saying there's some truth. I mean, the oyster is a best source of calcium, that you get more calcium than milk. There's zinc, magnesium, iron, copper. All the rare earth minerals are in the oysters.
Because I'm feeling a little sexy.
Well,
right
you
now.
Know, that's up to you. But they're good for you. They're definitely...
Mike's like, the show's over. I'm out of here.
But the... I think harvesting oysters is definitely the combination of the hard work and the hard labor of harvesting oysters and the consumption of oysters definitely make you feel better.
Yeah. Someone told me that the zinc is a sort of a building block to testosterone. So the idea of, you know, it could be based in reality somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a theory of there's only one natural source of testosterone. Do you know what that is?
What is that?
It's mint.
Mint?
Yes. Testosterone, you know... Mint is the source of all the world's problems, right? Community.
I'm not sure I follow. I don't know. My brain is working extra hard to follow here, but I'm not sure I get it.
Mint's heavily consumed in the Middle East.
Okay.
Heavily consumed.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a lot of problems in the Middle East. It's a staple of the Middle Eastern diet. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, so we're shucking another oyster here. Now, normally you don't use a what I'm familiar with. You use a much sharper version.
Right, I use a French knife, and you can only buy them in the city. Even the restaurant supplies don't. Only one restaurant supply store carries them.
Okay.
And that's J.B. Prince on 31st Street.
Hmm.
But it's a much sharper instrument, and it's got a beveled edge. See all the fluids coming out of this?
Yeah, I mean, we're making huge mess over
that's
here.
That's what you want.
Heritage Radio.
You want that.
This is the goopiest liquid-laden oyster I've ever seen.
Just taken out of the water, listen. Listen,
we're
10
talking
hours.
Talking
ago.
Hours, right. Yeah, right. And so, what's the muscle there? You have to.
That's the abductor that you know opens below water. They're going to open up, and then they're going to filter. So they have to have a muscle that opens and closes the shells. Right?
Mm. I do love. God, that's good. I do love oysters. Before
I always enjoyed oysters. Mm-hmm. Yes, I grew up eating oysters in Alabama and Mobile, on Mobile Bay. And whenever I could afford to go out and have an oyster here in Manhattan, which wasn't that frequently, I always had oysters.
I like this idea. I was reading a little article that I believe you actually wrote, which is, you know, at the time when you were on Wall Street, you know, the closer you were to the money, the more money you made. And the same could be said for oysters, that you eat a lot of oysters because, in fact, you are an oyster farmer.
That's right. No question, I eat a lot of oysters. So,
the tides have changed, but now you get to enjoy oysters every day.
Right, you can't eat money, right?
Right. How many oysters would you say you eat in a week?
Sure we eat at least 100 oysters a week. I enjoy oysters, and then my wife is an excellent cook. She often makes a oyster stew and... oyster gumbo, and then she makes a very nice oyster pot pie that the kids like.
I mean, some people would argue that, like, oysters, they're hard to cook with, right? Because they get a little rubbery if you don't know what you're doing.
You either cook them only for a few minutes, or you cook them for 3 hours.
I see.
They will, in between that, they're rubbery, but...
What is the 3 hours?
I read a recipe, you know, I don't know, the cookbook, Marjorie Kennan Rowland, she wrote The Yearling. Well, she lived down in Florida, and she wrote a cookbook about cooking, and she had the thing about oysters creole. She cooked them for 3 hours. I was shocked that they turned tender again.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Huh. And would you say that the rest of your family is, do they like Dad better as an oyster farmer?
Well, you know, how you ask your kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And my daughter said, well, I want to be what Dad does.
Wow.
Dad did. And I said, oh, you want to be an oyster farmer? She said, no, I want to be whatever you did before you were an oyster farmer.
and how old are your kids now?
My daughter's 10 and my son is 9.
Okay. And do they come out and harvest with you?
Yes, my children all work. As a matter of fact, last Christmas, Christmas is still the biggest day of the year for us.
Mm-hmm.
And last Christmas, we had a delivery the next day, so before they could open their presents, they all had to go out and get 1,000 oysters, which, you know, on a December day is not a joke.
Right, right.
And they did that, and then they opened their presents. And my son has been driving a boat since he's about 3 years old.
Wow.
And, it's not easy because you got to go backwards as hundreds of buoys, and you have to wind around. He's an excellent...
And you can't get the prop caught up in all the buoys.
Not on a winter day.
Scattered.
You know? No.
Yeah. I was worried about that when we went out because they're everywhere and they're tight. There's no turning space between them.
Right. And you got the current and the wind.
Right.
Tide.
Right. Would you say that, I guess this is, I think, what I'm really most interested in is that what happened in Manhattan, what happened in Wall Street, in your experience, which one could argue was about, you know, sort of selfishness, greed, misregulation, and things like that. Do you think that what happened to the oyster is in any way similar to what happened? Were the same forces at play?
I think, you know, greed is part of it. I think overconfidence is a big thing that, you know, people... I know for a fact in Wall Street thought that they were so smart, they had computers, they had figured out everything. When just the opposite was true. And I think in the heyday of oystering, no one ever thought that the time would come that they would that the supply of oysters. Now oysters were always farmed in the Peconic Bay where I am, but in those days they got the seed from the Connecticut rivers. Well, General Electric polluted those rivers with PCBs, and so the source of all the oysters just dried up because the seed beds were polluted.
Wow. I also heard that in research they've done, when they looked at the piles that the Indians made of, you know, along the banks of these oysters, that you can see larger oyster shells at the bottom of the heaps, which might suggest that even the Native Americans were taking, you know, first the biggest oysters they could, because that would be obvious to do. And then after time, they had smaller and smaller and smaller oysters. And then along came the Dutch and later the English. And by the time the Americans were Americans, there were pretty much not a whole lot of oysters left to go around.
Yeah, people do. It's their human nature is to take the biggest, the easiest thing, right? I mean, I've read that they found in oyster middens in Bay Ridge oysters that were 3 feet across.
Holy moly.
Yeah. It, almost every harbor on the east coast of the United States was blocked by an oyster reef. And most of the oysters were over a foot long.
Incredible. Yeah. So they would actually populate to the point where the reef became so high.
That's correct.
And then what? And then you'd have to harvest to get the boats through?
Well, they would wait for high tide.
Wait for high tide. Right. Incredible. And would you just, we're about to wrap up, but I'm really interested. Do you think that there's a chance for New York to have oyster populations again?
I think in New York Harbor, they are growing oysters again just to clean the waters, but you should never eat those oysters.
Mm-hmm.
You should come out and eat the Long Island oyster.
Right. I would highly suggest that these are some of the most incredible oysters I've ever had, and I grew up in, you know, Boston, Cape Cod area where we swore that we had the best oysters. Yeah. And I would maybe argue that these are better than the oysters I grew up with. So so much for the Wellfleet oyster. We're now very happy about the Greenport oyster.
Yeah, we call them Widow's Hole.
Widow's Hole oyster. And do you think the Clean Water Act of 1970 has done anything in the way of bringing back the possibility? Do you see a time in the future where we might be able to eat the oysters out of the East River?
East River, I'd say that. The human done. Population is so large, although the water is very fast moving. I mean, I know you go catch fish. Do you eat the fish that you eat there?
I do sometimes.
So, you know.
But I don't feel great.
Yeah, well. I would not, you know, I would not eat an oyster out of the East River.
Well, it is on the bottom as opposed to
maybe
the
if you
fish.
Cooked it.
Yeah. Well, awesome. I am here with Mike, who is really, I mean, I got to thank you for coming all the way this way. I know you had some deliveries to do, but it's a real pleasure to have you here. You have become a heavy hitter in oysterdom. So thank you so much
for
being
you.
Here.
Thanks, Ben.
And you're hearing it here on Heritage Radio, another episode of Catch It, Cook It, and Eat It.
Catching a brim. When the river's on, we jump off the bridge. When we get home, we play some deep. When the street on, we got a river and swim. When we go fishing, we catching a brim. When the river's on, we jump off the bridge. When we get home, we play some deep.